Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening. This is the Interpreter Foundation Radio Show, sponsored by LDSAgents.com. The Interpreter Foundation exists to encourage study of the gospel and faithfulness to the church by making the latest scholarship available in its journal, publishing books, holding seminars, creating documentary films, and by providing roundtable discussions of the scriptures. You can find us at interpreterfoundation.org, where you can find all of our materials, including these radio programs, which are posted as podcasts. You can also subscribe to this show on iTunes or through any of the other podcast apps on Apple and Android devices. And if you like the show, tell your friends about us and write a review on iTunes or on your favorite site for podcast apps. I'm Steve Densley, and tonight I'm joined in the studio by co-host Mark Johnson and on the phone by Professor Matthew Bowen from Brigham Young University, Hawaii. Aloha, Professor Bowen.
Aloha, Steve. Aloha, Mark.
Aloha.
Mark, why don't you tell us about our sponsor?
Oh, I'd be happy to. The Interpreter Radio Show is sponsored by LDSAgents.com, a network of over 3,000 friendly, top-quality real estate agents serving Latter-day Saints in the United States and Canada for more than 20 years. Whether you're buying or selling a home, contact LDSAgents.com. Their professional, friendly real estate agents will help you find just the right home you're looking for that meets your needs in a safe neighborhood with the right schools and with a temple not far away. Now, it's easy to find a real estate agent who speaks your language and shares your values. Whether you're buying or selling, no matter where you are, let LDS agents reduce the stress of your move. That's LDSagents.com.
We are talking about the Come Follow Me lesson that covers Genesis 28 through 33. And this is a follow-up on really a saga, family saga, that begins with Abraham and the Abrahamic covenant. It continues on to Isaac, and we hear the Abrahamic covenant repeated to Isaac so that he is, and his descendants are recipients of the blessings and the promises that were made to Abraham. And then we see this repeated in Jacob as well. And I just think that these stories are great because of the way that we can place ourselves in these roles, and that as Abraham is, the father of many nations, that, the exalted father, that we also can become, the parents of many nations, exalted parents, through faithfulness to these covenants and, as recipients of the covenants that have been made to our progenitors. And then we see throughout the Old Testament these characters who are flawed and, make sometimes really serious mistakes, and yet God honors the promises he's made to their forefathers, promises he's made to them, and blesses them in spite of themselves, and continually tries to draw them in, to draw them closer to him, and help them to learn what they need to be, what they need to do to be happy. Mm-hmm. And maybe more than any other book in Scripture, the Old Testament it's this very human message. These people that are just so much like us, or maybe hopefully we're better than them in many ways. I mean, they just do some really scary things. We're wondering what in the world's going on here. Mm-hmm. And yet the Lord sticks with them, keeps on trying to draw them back. I think there's a lot of hope in that message.
I think so too. And we've got, like you just said, Steve, so many, problems in these people's lives, and many of them are their own doing. Not all of them. But I was noticing in our reading as I was preparing for the show what a struggle Jacob's family had. There are so many of, us, people we know, members of our families that have marriage problems, for instance. And if you think you've got some marriage problems, go read Jacob's story. He's got, two wives, and it's blatant and obvious. It says so in the start of the story that he loves one wife more than he does the other. And right there, I already know that there's going to be problems, because that's not how you do it.
Well, I mean, you know, Jacob's problems start before that, don't they? I mean, reading from the prior Come Follow Me lesson, we read about his struggles with his own brother, and, mm-hmm. you know, and how really Jacob, it begins at birth. You know,
yeah, it does. Even from the womb.
Yeah. So he's grabbing onto his brother's heel, mm-hmm. you know, as his brother's, you know, emerging from the birth canal. And so they're, you know, it's like they're fighting before they're even born. And, you know, and so,
it could have been my kids for, you know.
Yeah, I mean, brothers and sisters, you know, how we, you know, sometimes struggle with each other and, you mm-hmm. know, try to get the upper hand. And so Jacob is kind of seen as this supplanter, the person who's taking the place of, you know, his older brother. He's, you know, kind of pulling him down, trying to, mm-hmm. you know, get on top.
I just wanted to make a comment here that these stories, and we were talking about this the last hour, they were very important to Lehi's family and to Nephi, and as we will hopefully talk about today, Enos. Mm-hmm. This idea, you know, the interfamilial conflict, the story of Joseph and his brothers, the fraternal problems there, and the story of Jacob and Esau and their fraternal problems. I love the arc that we're going to be covering, because at the end of 27, Esau wants to kill Jacob. But by the end of the chapters we're going to be covering, it's a very different situation.
Well, it starts out with our reading this week, you know, where you said, Professor Bowen, that Esau wants to kill Jacob. Remember how Jacob, who is... What does the word Jacob mean in Hebrew, Professor Bowen?
The name Jacob, or Yaakov, means may he protect, meaning may the deity protect this individual. But it was so close in sound to the root Akav or Akave in Hebrew that they associated it with the idea of grabbing the heel or supplanting, as you noted. And so there's this, you know, you have the...
Again, a sort of play on words.
Yes. So there's a very positive, you know, the origin of the name is very positive, but it, you know, in Jacob's personal story, it acquires this very, you know, a much more colorful meaning in terms of, you know, the way his life plays out.
Yeah, and I think that's the fun part about knowing about these connections back to the original Hebrew language that it was written in, is that, you know, once you see these puns and these, you know, these allusions and wordplays, we realize that the narrator is almost giving it all away right at the very beginning of the story. You know, he's giving us an extra bit of flavor. We've got two different word roots and two different, you know, versions of the name, as it were, that will, you know, color everything that's coming down the road.
Right. Well, there's that the word play again, you know, in Genesis 27, verse 36, you know, after Jacob's tricked Esau out of, you know, we have the incident of the you know, the birthright issue, but then also the blessing. And Esau says, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he hath supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now he's taken away my blessing." So, you know, it's like you say, Professor Bowen, Jacob, that, you know, that word that maybe sounds like supplanting, "For he hath supplanted me." So in English, we lose that. But then, yep. You know, if you know what he's talking about in Hebrew, or how you would say that in Hebrew, you see that there's this emphasis on how Jacob is supplanting Esau. And, you know, there's early on, you know, just, you know, Rebecca's wondering what's going on, you know, with these children that, you know, she says that they struggle together within her. Why is that? And the Lord said unto her, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels, and the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. So Rebecca knows right from the beginning that the one that's coming out second is going to be the ruler. You know, he's going to be, you know, the younger one, or the older one's going to serve the younger one. You wonder, you know, did she ever mention this to Jacob? As Jacob is kind of scheming, you know, trying to figure out, what can I do to maybe make this revelation come to pass? Maybe using some improper means to bring about something that is eventually foretold. And he gets this reputation through the ages as the trickster, you know, that he is trying to trick, you know, his brother out of the birthright, trying to trick his father into giving him this blessing. And there's no really indication in the text, I don't think, that it was successful, was it? I mean, you know, he's not really getting these blessings because he tricked Esau tricked Jacob, or, I mean, his father.
Certainly not tricking. He's not tricking the Lord by getting the blessings.
Yeah. But in any event, I mean, you know, I don't want to step on the toes of the radio program that came before us. You know, we ought to move on to our week. But the point is that this sets it up so that Esau has it out for Jacob. He says, that's it. I am going to kill this guy. You know, I am not going to stand for this any longer. Now, in the meantime, Esau has married some Hittite women, and, you know, Rebecca is kind of panicked about this. What's going to happen with Jacob? And Jacob, you know, is recognized as the holder of the birthright by this point, you know, and it's going to be important for him to maintain the birthright lineage by marrying within the covenant. And so, you know, Rebecca says, you know, you need to have a talk with your son, Isaac. And so in chapter 28, verse 1, Isaac called Jacob and blessed him. Now, Isaac very clearly knows who he's blessing at this point. You know, very clearly, Jacob is receiving the blessing that's intended for him, and Isaac knows this. Isaac charged him and said unto him, thou shalt not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. Arise and go to Padam Aram, to the house of Bethuel, my mother's father, and take a wife from thence of the daughters of Laban, thy mother's brother. And so Jacob hightails it out of there and heads off to meet up with Laban. And Laban, as it turns out, is a trickster himself. Mm-hmm. But before he gets there, let's talk about this vision. He's on his way, you know, to meet up with these people. What happens, Mark, along the way here?
Well, this is chapter 28. It starts off, and I think just in the slight diversion here, it mentions that he, you know, was out at night traveling, and he says in verse 11, took the stones of that place and put them for his pillows and lay down to sleep. The idea of stones in these chapters is kind of a literary device that they use. It's a motif. And we find the stones popping up again and again when he gets to where Laban is, when he first meets Rachel there at a well with a great stone that was covering it. Further on in the text, it talks about how Jacob would make altars and little landmarkers of stone. Jacob is kind of the rough stone rolling of his... Of the patriarchs. He's got, you know, all these things in this tough journey that he's taking, and, you know, he's busy being polished throughout the story. So as we read these stories, you can see the word stone popping up over and over again as kind of a symbol for who Jacob is and what he's like. just rough and rugged.
So he lays up those stones, mm-hmm. and then he sleeps on them, if you can imagine. Which is actually, I mean, if you start studying antiquity and seeing some of the things that they slept on, you know, it's kind of shocking, but they actually did sleep on these really hard surfaces, mm-hmm. You know, maybe prop up their head with, you know, some solid thing. Mm-hmm. That's what Jacob's doing here. He's laying down his place to sleep. And what happens?
Well, he sees a vision. He sees this vision of a ladder that is set up on the earth. And it reaches up into heaven, and he sees the angels of God climbing up and down the ladder, and the angels are bringing blessings, it says, to the children of men. And
I want to just insert here that word ladder
mm-hmm.
probably is not the best translation for that word. The Hebrew word is slam, and what that word means is really a staircase. It's a staircase that is mediating between heaven and earth.
Well, and if we think about the kinds of things, well, the Tower of Babel, for example, I mean, this, you know, what's called a ziggurat in Mesopotamia. So if we think about a structure with maybe stairways or ramps that are
yep.
leading upward, you know, toward the heavens, with the idea
Correct.
In mind that it's going to lead us up toward God, or the, you know, the realm of God, that, you know, this you know, up where the, you know, the firmament, the dome that covers the, you know, that you know, separates the sky from us.
In fact, that's in Mesopotamia they had this. It's an old Assyrian term. It was Simalat Shamami, and it literally breaks down to stairway to heaven. I mean, that's the idea. That and that's sort of the idea that's embodied in the ziggurat structure.
So what are we to make of this? There's these angels going up and down this, you know, stepped pyramid, or, you know, ziggurat, you know, on these steps or ramps, coming up and down. And so what does that mean?
The prophet Joseph Smith talked about the temple, which we'll talk more about in a minute. The temple represents the three principal rounds of Jacob's ladder or staircase, that the tripartite temple structure is, you know, conveys the idea that is, or, you know, or concept that's being conveyed right here.
Right. Joseph Smith talks about, you know, Paul seeing, you know, the, or being caught up to the third heaven, you know, that, Joseph Smith definitely sees this as representative of the degrees of glory, you know, and then, you know, angels maybe receiving messages from God, bringing them down to us, and then,
yeah.
you know, going back up to God to report on what they've done.
And that's what the word is. It's messengers of God, really. I mean, that's what all an angel in... You look at the Hebrew terminology or Greek terminology, a malach in Hebrew or an angelos in Greek is a messenger bearing a message.
Well, and then who does Jacob see, Professor Bowen?
Then he sees the Lord, and in the King James Version it says, "Behold, the Lord stood above it." But that same language right there in Hebrew could mean the Lord stood beside him, meaning stood beside Jacob, and said, "I am the Lord God of Abraham, my father, and the God of Isaac." And then here comes the bequest of the land again, "The land whereon thou liest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed."
Right.
And thy
so
seed
this
shall...
This is a reconfirmation then of the covenants that were made to Abraham and Isaac, and continues on to the next verse.
Yeah, "And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south, and in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed."
Well, I like, too, how in the next verse we have this... this phrase here, I am with thee and will keep thee in all places whithersoever thou goest, and I will bring thee again into this land, for I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken of. It reminds
me. And that word.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say that word keep, shamar in Hebrew. The idea of it, it also means to protect, and that that word surfaces again in Jacob's prayer later when we get to Genesis. Later in the, I think it's in Genesis 32, if I'm not misremembering. But the angel who's kept, or no, that's later. I'm sorry, that is later in. It's later on in the Joseph story where Jacob refers to the angel who's kept him from all evil. Maybe that's Genesis 48, where, and it means it's the angel who's protected him. But in here it's the Lord as a, you know, the messenger of the Father who's promising, I'll keep thee in all the places whither thou goest. And then the promise, I will bring thee again to this land, for I will not leave thee until I have done all, or have done that which I have spoken to thee of.
Well, you know, this is early on in Jacob's story here, where he's being promised all these amazing things, and, you know, his comment in the next verse, surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. You know, he reveals, he kind of tips his hand here, he's telling us that he didn't really realize, you know, where he was or what was going on here. He seems almost ignorant of the Lord and the Lord's blessings. He's just a neophyte at this point. This reminds me a little bit of, well, you know, imagine a newly baptized child partaking of the sacrament and the kinds of blessings that come through the sacrament covenant, and how we're promised that if we will keep the commandments and always remember him, that we may have his spirit to be with us. So God will be with us always if we keep these covenants that we've made. I mean, that's a amazing promise that is made to us, and it's made to young children. So, you know, look again at verse 15. I am with thee and will keep thee in all places whithersoever thou goest. I will not leave thee. Very reminiscent to me of the promises that are made to us in the sacrament prayer. You know, if we're faithful to our covenants, we can have God as our companion. And then, you know, this comment, it's just like, wow, God's here and I didn't even know it. You know, I think that that's the kind of experience that we have. It's, you know, at some point we come to a realization that God is here and we didn't even know it.
Yeah, it almost reminds me of, it does remind me of Peter's declaration on the Mount of Transfiguration after, you know, all that he'd seen. He says, you know, oh, it's good for us to be here. You know, we should, you know, make some tabernacles or something to mark this.
Well, and that's a good point. You know, in the next verse, you know, he says, this is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. And he rose up early in the morning and took a stone that he had put for his pillows and set it up for a pillar and poured oil upon the top of it. And he called the name of that place Beth-El. So what does Beth-El mean in Hebrew, Professor Bowen?
Beth-El is, Beth is a Hebrew word many people will know. It just means house. It's the same element in Bethlehem, house of bread. Beth means house, and El is it was a common Semitic term in all Semitic languages in one form or another for God or a deity.
Right. We're maybe more familiar with the phrase Elohim.
Right.
You know, same
phrase,
root.
That phrase is used in the Hebrew in this chapter in a couple of places. You know, the Beth Elohim is when he says house of God in this chapter. It's in verse 17. That's Beth Elohim.
Right, and so this becomes a sort of house of God. So this place where he, you know, sees the angels coming down and returning to God, the messengers, right? We see these different degrees of glory, the different levels of this this structure that he's seeing. There's these promises that the Abrahamic covenant is renewed. That there's promises that that God will always be with him. Really, very reminiscent of our holy places of worship, and especially not just our chapels where we partake of the sacrament, but also our temples where we have a sort of vision of the kingdoms of glory, and passing through them in ascending order, so that we can come into the presence of God. So very rich in temple symbolism here.
Very rich. In fact, I think this was mentioned by President, I'm trying to remember if this was President Harold B. Lee or Elder President Elder N. Eldon Towner, but the quote was, "What Bethel, all that Bethel was to Jacob is what the temple is to us today."
Well, and we get kind of a sense of Jacob's, again, he's a neophyte here. He's just kind of beginning in his tutelage. And it says in verse 20, he vowed a vow saying, "If God be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on," he says in verse 22, "All that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee." So there's still kind of this hedging his bets, It's like, well, if God's going to bless me, then I'm going to pay my tithing. There's a sense in which Jacob hasn't quite fully committed. We see this transformation or this progression that he goes through, but God's with him. I mean, we baptize children when they're 8 years old, and they need to learn and they need to progress. These promises, or amazing promises, are made to our young children, and you can imagine our kids saying the same thing. Well, if God's going to bless me, then I'll pay my tithing. Mm-hmm. So I love the way in which Jacob is portrayed here as being quite human.
I have that quote now, and I misattributed it.
Is this the Marion G. Romney quote?
Yeah, it's the Marion G. Romney quote. Yeah, Jacob realized that the covenants that he made with the Lord were the rungs on the ladder that he himself would have to climb in order to obtain the promised blessing. Blessings that would entitle him to enter heaven and associate with the Lord, because he had met the Lord and entered into covenants with him there. Jacob considered the site so sacred that he named the place Bethel, a contraction of Beth Elohim, which means literally the house of the Lord. Temples are to us all what Bethel was to Jacob. Unquote. That was in March 1971.
That was a pretty good quote. And he goes on to say, right after that, after saying what Bethel is to Jacob, he says, "Even more, they are also the gates of heaven for all of our unendowed kindred dead. We should all do our duty in bringing our loved ones through those gates."
Well, and before we leave this chapter, I just want to emphasize, these covenants that we talk about, they're not mere promises that Jacob and Isaac and Abraham are going to get a lot of stuff. They're not merely promises that they're going to have lots of kids. Part of this covenant is that in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Okay, so in verse 14, it says that, and so the idea here is, not that you guys are going to be rich, but that by virtue of these promises I'm making with you, that everyone else is going to be blessed. And these are blessings to all of God's children.
They're very forward-looking promises. In fact, Hebrews 11, you know, the writer makes the point that the Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah and so forth, they died not seeing most of the promises that were made to them. But they trusted that the God who made them would be faithful. And, they understood that they were seeing with an eye of faith, as Moroni describes it later, the fulfillment of the promises.
It reminds me of go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, including the idea that God is going to fulfill them well beyond the span of mortal life, and implicit in that is the idea of that God will raise up the dead, and he'll resurrect the dead in order to that they can, because he's going to perform every single promise that he's made. So the idea back in the chapter, I will not leave thee until I've performed that which I have spoken. That he's going to, he's in it to fulfill every promise to the uttermost, and we can't even begin to imagine the scale on which that is true, and to the degree that those promises apply to each one of us as we make and keep the covenants.
Yeah, I like that, and it reminds me of Simeon a little bit in the New Testament there, where he was promised to, see the Lord before he, see the Messiah before he passed away, and it was, just right there near the very end. He was a very old man by the time that was, that promise was fulfilled, but, God was good to his word, and he told Enos he couldn't lie. He fulfilled that promise, and sometimes, we have to do the same. We have to use our own patience and wrestle with the Lord as we go through our lives, and eventually, according to God's time, we'll get all those blessings. The Lord will prove himself good for that.
Well, and then in chapter 29, Jacob then comes on to Laban's land, and he meets Rachel at that well. Mark was talking about before. And smitten by Jacob, absolutely taken with her. And so he wants to marry Rachel. And Laban says, well, we've got this deal here where, it's Jacob. Jacob apparently doesn't have money, right? And, normally you'd have to pay this bride price. So rather than paying this bride price, he's got to work for 7 years in order to marry Rachel. And there's a verse here that, maybe most romantic verse in all of Scripture. Says that in verse 20, Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed unto him but a few days for the love he had to her. I think that's awesome. He is just so... He's so caught up with this girl. He's going to work for her for 7 years, and it just, time passes quickly because he, this great thing he's going to get after the end of 7 years. And then what happens, Mark?
The old bait and switch.
The bait and switch is really interesting here because, think about what happened when Jacob pulled his own bait and switch.
Mm-hmm.
You have his father who his eyes are dimmed by blindness. And, he approaches his father, where he couldn't see his son and receives this blessing. It seems that, there's this kind of irony here in this.
Poetic
this,
justice.
This part of the
yeah.
irony and poetic justice.
Goes around, comes around.
Yes.
Jacob is going into this dark tent. It may be even that maybe this woman is veiled. He spends the night with her and doesn't realize that this isn't Rachel. He's been duped. Mm-hmm. He's, the veil has been pulled over his eyes. And so he goes back again to Jacob. And he says, "Hey, what gives?" And he said, "Well, you know, there's this thing where, you know, we can't have the younger married before the older." Again, there's kind of this irony here where, you know, Jacob is in some sense trying to supplant the, you know, the station of the older child mm-hmm. by taking the younger first, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, going against the cultural expectations of primogeniture. You know, where the oldest would get the expected birthright, you know, the double portion.
Yeah, and so, you know, Jacob, again, is trying to do things out of order. Doesn't quite work for him. Jacob pulls a fast, or Laban pulls a fast one. It's interesting mm-hmm. how many times Labans turn up in the scriptures that, you know, are kind of questionable characters. Mm-hmm. What does the name Laban mean, Professor Bowen? It
means white. Laban is the term. In fact, it's when we get to chapter 31. It's a part of the wordplay.
Well,
in that
think
chapter,
you think that's ironic, naming him white?
it could be. I mean, it's Laban's a really interesting character in this account.
He's not quite white, is he? He's more kind of gray or
a gray
white,
area.
Right? He's not wearing the white hat in this story.
And then there's Laban backwards, right?
Nabal.
Which means fool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's more of that that could be made. And I think, I want to say, Taylor Halverson has done something with that.
Yeah,
in
there's an interpretive
the Book of Mormon.
Article about that. And he mentioned that about reading Nephi in light of the wisdom traditions.
Well, so what happens then is he ends up marrying Rachel and Leah. And as it turns out, Rachel's barren. She can't have children. Leah just starts turning out the children. At one point, you know, in chapter 30, it's kind of this interesting episode where Reuben, one of Leah's children, ends up finding some mandrakes. And Rachel says to Leah, "Give me, I pray thee, thy son's mandrakes." What's going on here, Professor Bowen? Why does Rachel want the mandrakes?
Rachel wants the mandrakes. The mandrakes are associated with, in fact, the Hebrew word is very close to one of the most important words for love, one of the most important roots. And the mandrakes are associated with fertility, and she really wants that.
Yeah, she's just heartbroken. She can't have these children. She figures that she's going to use this kind of folk remedy or maybe magic to try to, you know, to help her to have children. And what happens instead?
Well, it ends up that, to make a long story short, Leah is able to bear two more children.
Yeah, so Rachel's figuring, here's my big break. I got these mandrakes. And what ends up happening is Leah goes and has more children. I think there's this message.
This contest of having children, and you know, Rachel's sort of really behind in the count, we'll put it. I mean, she's... Leah's had all these children before Rachel even has one.
Well, and I think that there's a message here where, you know, we go back to, you know, Jacob and Rebecca trying to kind of force God's hand. You know, we know that there's this promise that they're going to be, you know, the birthright is going to come to Jacob. So, you know, let's see what we can do. Let's try to, let's get Esau to sell his birthright. Let's trick Isaac into giving a blessing to Jacob, and that backfires, so that now Esau just becomes, you know, murderously angry. So Jacob's got to run away, try to steer clear of Esau. And in this instance, Rachel is, you know, trying to figure out, what do I do to have children? And so, you know, she resorts to, you know, some extra scriptural means of trying to, you know, have children, and it doesn't work for her. I think that, you know, one of the messages we can get from this is that, you know, God's ways aren't our ways, that, you know, God has his own timeline. You know, when promises have been made, we ought to be patient and trust in God. You know, it doesn't help to try to force God's hand. In fact,
yeah, I mean, there's a connection right there back to the Abraham and Sarah story, where, you know, Sarah gets impatient, and, you know, the way the text reads in the canonical text, you know, she gives her handmaid to Abraham, and that creates even more of an issue for her. But what we see at the end is that the Lord did have a timetable for Rachel, and things work out at the right time.
Right. Well, so...
Let me jump in real quick to it. I think it's hard also not to feel difficult and, you know, maybe just a little bit tender for Leah, too, because after she names her children, you know, each time she says something to the effect of, and this is with... Zebulon, he says, you know, God is, you know, endowed is the right word there. I mean, with a good dowry. And then she says, you know, maybe now my husband will dwell with me because I have six sons. You know, she, you know, was providing all the children and doing all that she wanted to. But at the same time, you know, Rachel was still the favorite.
Well, and consider, too, how the royal line comes through Leah. You know, mm-hmm. Jesus Christ mm-hmm. is descended through Leah. You know, if Jacob would have had his way, he wouldn't have married Leah in the first place. Mm-hmm. You know, so again, you know, God has his plans, and we have our own plans, and, you know, what do they say? If you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the other messages we're getting here is that God has something in mind, that he has a great work to do. And sometimes we have to step back and, you know, and let God do his work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so Jacob becomes... it's a little bit unclear exactly what's happening here. He maybe feels like, you know, he's done his time. He's maybe paid his price, you know, for these women, you know, to Laban.
Laban's gotten rich off of him.
Yeah.
Laban himself admits that the Lord's made him wealthy.
Yeah,
through
it's really
Jacob.
Time for Jacob to leave. But it's a little bit unclear, I think. I mean, you know, maybe you have some insight on this, Professor Bowen, but it almost sounds like that Jacob is an indentured servant, you know, that all of the belongings of Jacob, because of his indentured servitude, belong to Laban, including his wives and children. I mean, he has to go to Laban and sort of beg that he can leave with his possessions, or, you know, with, you know, his wives and children. And, you know, kind of strikes his deal with Laban, you know, well, just, you know, give me the imperfect animals. Give me the ones that are speckled and, you know, the ones that, you know, these would be the, you know, maybe considered inferior. You know, and Laban says, yeah, that's just fine. We'll do that. And then Laban, being Laban, comes up with, he pulls a fast one. Mm-hmm. He tells his sons, hey, guys, go grab all those speckled cows and, you know, and the goats and hightail it out of here for 3 days. So then by the time Jacob goes to look for the animals, there aren't any. So Mark, what does he do?
Jacob. Yeah. He kind of pulls a fast one of his own. He goes in what is it? He like every time a new lamb is born, he'll keep the good one for himself. Or I'm not reading that. Oh, doesn't he paint?
Yeah. Well, he, like, so what he does
disguise them, right?
He takes some you know, basically sticks, mm-hmm. and sets them up where the animals are watering, and you know these are. You know, he puts them, you know, with
there it is.
It says white streaks in them. You know, made the white to appear, which was in the rods. So verse 37 of chapter 30, what he's doing, is he is employing apparently some kind of a folk practice, or you know, some kind of there was, you know, anciently, and this is a belief that I think has prevailed for some time later, is that, you know, when maybe an animal or a woman is conceiving, that what they see will impact their child, or the animal that's being born, that there's some kind of effect, you know, on the animal or child. And so because of this, the animals that are born end up being spotted and speckled, and so Jacob then starts taking the strongest animals, the healthiest ones, and he engages in this kind of genetic engineering, where he's transforming Laban's flock into his own, you know, or at least he's taking all the strongest animals that are being born by setting up these sticks so that when the calves are born, they'll be born speckled, and so the best ones end up as his. Now,
there's another level of symbolism here too. The name Leah is means cow, and the name Rachel means ewe lamb, and so it's kind of the transformation of Laban's family, you know, his daughters, to Jacob's family.
Oh, interesting.
A transfer and a transformation.
Hmm. Right. Well, and I think this is really interesting, too, because it appears as though Jacob is using magic, you know, that he is, I mean, or at least a folk practice in order to accomplish his ends. And then in chapter 31, we read that the angel of God spoke unto Jacob in a dream, saying, Jacob... And I said, here I am. And he said, lift up now thine eyes and see, all the rams which leapt upon the cattle are ring-straked, speckled, and gristled. For I have seen all that Laban doeth unto thee. And I am the God of Bethel, where thou anointest the pillar. So it appears that Jacob is saying, God instructed me on how to do this. And that's what happened. That's how I ended up with all these great cattle. And goats, and you know, this great herd, is because it was by virtue of revelation. Now, to me, I mean, this really reminds me of modern church history, where we read about Joseph Smith using, you know, what was commonly referred to at the time as a peep stone. We call it a seer stone. And then we also read about Oliver Cowdery using a divining rod, you know, that was changed in the Doctrine and Covenants to refer to the gift of Aaron. But, you know, these are, you know, folk practices that were used at the time, but were directed to Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery by God. And, you know, it seems that there are times that God, for his purposes, can direct us to do things that, you know, maybe in the hands of other people are, you know, improperly done. Trying to remember, wasn't there a divining bowl that Joseph of Egypt was using?
Yeah, that he's using that cup to divine. And, I mean, there's the example in the book of Moses. And the Savior does this later when he tells someone to put, you know, he puts, makes clay out of spit and puts it on the guy's eyes and he makes him see. And the Lord tells Enoch to anoint his eyes and wash them, and then he's able to see.
Right.
And Moses 6.
Right. So, fascinating that, you know, that these kinds of things are done. I mean, we could talk a little bit more maybe about the local gods that Jacob has in his house that Leah steals. You know, these are probably indicative of right to inheritance, and, you know, maybe Rachel's making a statement there, you know, and taking those.
And maybe a nice you know, literary callback to Abraham's experience in his early days, where he was said to have, you know, smashed all the gods from his father's house.
Yeah. But, you know, in our last minutes here, I want to make sure we get to this story of Jacob encountering this angel. So he's on his way back. He gets this message that his brother Esau has come to meet him with an army of 400 people, so he's scared to death. What's going to happen? Esau wants to kill me. You know, so Jacob decides he wants to present a gift, you know, to Esau, but he hasn't met him yet. Doesn't know what's going to happen. And in chapter 32, it says Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. So you know, Jacob is
messengers. Yeah,
the messengers of God. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau. After that, so then Jacob's left alone. Verse 24. And there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And in verse 26, the man said, "Let me go, for the day breaketh." So it's, you know, the dawn is about to come. They've been wrestling all night, apparently. And he said, "I will not let thee go, except thou bless me." And then verse 27, so this man that he's encountering says, "What is thy name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Thy name shall no more be called Jacob, but Israel. For a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed." As a prince hast thou power with God and prevailed. Now, the language here is a bit obscure in the King James English. But then he, in verse 29, he blessed him there. Okay, so what we have then is this encounter where it talks about wrestling. Well, you know, it could also be interpreted as, you know, an embrace.
Yes.
Where the this man asks Jacob, "What is your name?" And Jacob tells him his name, and then he's given a new name, and then he is given a blessing. So Professor Bowen, can you maybe elaborate on this and tell us what's the larger message we should be getting out of what's going on here?
Well, this is the, well, we talked about the name Jacob, meaning may he protect. There's wordplay going on in the whole story or here about the wrestle, you know, with the word Yaavek, which sounds like the name Jacob. And he's wrestling with a man, and you remember in the Book of Mormon, Enos, whose name means man, talks about the wrestle that he had before God, and that word before God, Lifnei, Elohim, might have to something to do with Peniel here, face of God. And the he receives this new name that he gets, like the name change for Abraham is indicative of his destiny. You mentioned earlier in the show that the name can mean not just, you know, let God prevail, but the verb that it comes from can mean to struggle.
Struggle with God.
Yeah, Jacob's descendants will struggle with God, very much like what you read in Jacob 5 and the allegory of the olive tree.
Well, and Jacob's saying, "I'm not going to let you go until you bless me."
Yeah, and eventually, though, you read in Jacob 5 in the story of the allegory of the olive tree, God's will prevails. You know, I've done according to my will, and it all sort of works out. Even, you know, both meanings, let God prevail, but also prevailing with God or struggling with God. And yeah, one of the larger messages here is that you know, the Lord's will is done in Jacob's life. And in the next chapter, in chapter 33, where he's terrified that his brother is going to kill him, as before, instead, we have this beautiful reconciliation moment where, verse 4, Esau ran to meet him and embraced him. And the word is, there is Havak, which, and the form of the verb is very close to the name Jacob. And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him. And Jacob gives him the gift, and in verse 10, Jacob says, I pray thee, if I have found grace in thy sight, then receive my present at my hand, for therefore I have seen thy face as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. And this reconciliation with his brother is symbolic of the reconciliation we have with God. You remember the end of the Book of Enos in the Book of Mormon, where Enos uses language very similar to this, that I'll see his face with pleasure, and he will say unto me, come, ye blessed, and inherit the kingdom which is prepared for you. And he sees the face of God with pleasure.
Well, and there's this question of, you know, who is this man that's wrestling with Jacob? You know, and there are different theories. You know, the word Elohim is used here. You know, but people wonder, you know, are we talking about a messenger of God? Are we talking about,
the Savior himself?
Yeah.
And I mentioned earlier in the show that, you know, that redeeming angel, Genesis 48, who's redeemed him from all evil. I think that, you know, and it's the same individual, perhaps, in, you know, here it's left ambiguous, and I think that that's intentional. But, you know, there's this special relationship that Jacob has with this Goel, this Redeemer.
Well, that Jacob seems to be seeing this as a experience where he is entering into the presence of God. You know, says that I have seen God face to face and my life is preserved. So let me just end with President Nelson's comments on this, where he says, are you willing to let God prevail in your life? Are you willing to let God be the most important influence in your life? Will you allow his words, his commandments, his covenants to influence what you do each day? Will you allow his voice to take priority over any other? Are you willing to let whatever he needs you to do take precedence over every other ambition? Are you willing to have your life swallowed up in his? How does the Lord feel about people who will let God prevail? Nephi summed it up well. The Lord loveth those who will have him be their God. Behold, he loved our fathers, and he covenanted with them, yea, even Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he remembereth the covenants which he hath made. And that's the message from these chapters. That's the message we leave with you. This is the Interpreter Radio Show. Thanks for joining us.